Me.
I don't know what you're talking about.
What, you think I'm not much different from one of Pavlov's dogs?
Not much different from one of Mizunami's cockroaches, actually. Haven't you heard? Scientists in Japan have conducted their own Pavlovian experiment, but using cockroaches. They exposed a group of cockroaches to a particular odor every time they gave them a sugar solution to feast on. Later, when they exposed them to the odor alone, no sugar solution in sight, the little devils drooled.
Gross.
Their control group was given the sugar solution without being exposed to the odor. When this group was later exposed to the odor alone, no sugar solution, they produced no more saliva than normal.
Are you telling me this in order to ruin my truffle eating experience?
I'm telling you this because this study is pretty cool when you think about it. It means that even very simple-brained creatures like cockroaches can learn and remember.
That is cool and completely terrifying. I guess that with this and their infamous resilience, cockroaches have the brains and the brawn.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University.
Today's program was prepared by Michelle Ross, with help from Preston Garrity in Psychological and Brain Sciences.
There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. To get podcasts, click on the podcast button. For a moment of science, I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:41 in sports. The NCAA says Indiana basketball coach Calvin Sampson and his staff violated telephone recruiting restrictions imposed because of his previous violations at Oklahoma, then lied about it to the school and NCAA investigators. The report accuses Sampson of five major violations, including the allegation of providing, quote, false or misleading information. The school contended in its initial report that all violations were secondary infractions. The NCAA accused Sampson of failing to follow a generally recognized high standard of honesty and failing to promote an atmosphere of compliance within the men's basketball program. Athletic Director Rick Greenspan says the university will cooperate with all NCAA requests. Major violations of rules can include bans on postseason play. Bruce Weber was as curious as anybody to see how Illinois would respond after a double overtime loss to Indiana last week. Turns out the Illini are a resilient bunch. Trent Meacham made all five of his three-pointers and scored 19 points as Illinois continued its dominance of Minnesota with an 84-60 victory last night in Minneapolis. Northwestern plays host to Ohio State in Big Ten basketball play tonight. The Buckeyes hold a 4-44 advantage in the all-time series, and they're 42-30 in games played at Northwestern. The Chicago Blackhawks are in Ohio tonight to face off against Columbus. And a second session of questions and answers involving Roger Clemens and Brian McNamee is underway this afternoon on Capitol Hill. Neither man is backing off his opening comments. For Clemens, that means constant denials that he has done anything wrong. And for McNamee, that means he continues to say he injected Clemens with steroids and human growth hormone. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards.
There are fears in Pakistan that a growing insurgency and political turmoil could get worse. These crises have overshadowed a more hidden but growing crisis. Since 2001, several thousand Pakistanis have been swept up in the war of terror, locked away without charge. Jackie Northam has this story about one man.
In late February 2006, Dr. Safdar Sarki, a Pakistani-American doctor, was wrapping up a visit to Pakistan. Sarki lived in Texas with his wife and three children, but regularly made visits to Pakistan to campaign for the rights of a minority group in the populous Sindh province. John Sifton is a lawyer working on Sarki's case. He points out that Sarki did not make it back to Texas.
A few days before he was set to leave, some government forces believed to be in the ISI, Pakistan's Intelligence Service, came into his apartment and started questioning him. They beat him, and they took him away. Nobody ever saw him again for quite a long time.
In fact, it was over a year and a half before Sarki reappeared. Last October, Pakistan's Supreme Court ruled that Sarki was a victim of what it called an enforced disappearance and demanded that he be presented in court. Shortly after, police in the remote province of Balochistan said they had just arrested Sarki on weapons charges, but gave no details. Since then, Sarki's case has bounced from one court and from one judge to another. He's in solitary confinement in a primitive jail in the town of Zob, in the tribal region of Balochistan province. His Pakistani lawyer, Mohammad Khan Sheikh, says Sarki's health is deteriorating. He has a dual hernia and a degenerative eye condition.
Doctor visited him and checked him, and he stated before the court that he can be lose his eyesight forever. He can be blind if his treatment will be not done in any competent hospital.
A provincial court ordered that Sarki be transferred to a hospital for treatment, but the order was ignored. So too were requests for visits in prison from his family, friends, or lawyers. Sarki's case is similar to thousands of other Pakistanis. According to Pakistani human rights officials, about 4,000 people have disappeared since late 2001, when President Pervez Musharraf entered into an alliance with the U.S. in the so-called War on Terror. About 500 of the disappeared are suspected to have links to terrorism. The bulk of the others have nothing to do with terrorism, says Iqbal Haider, the General Secretary of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan.
This is just to victimize them, because they demand provincial autonomy. They demand their right to rule their own government. Their agenda is absolutely political, nothing to do with those fanatic religious militants.
The difference with Sarki is that he's a naturalized American citizen. U.S. officials in Pakistan and Washington say they've been pushing incessantly in all the key Pakistani ministries for consular access or medical treatment for Sarki, but they've been rebuffed or ignored every step of the way. Like many others, Sarki's lawyer, Khan, doesn't believe the U.S. is doing enough. He says after the hundreds of millions of dollars that the U.S. has poured into Pakistan over the past few years, the U.S. should have leverage.
Everybody knows there is a much more influence of American government in Pakistan. If American government put pressure on Pakistan government, they will release him on their day. But I am feeling that America government is not helping the Dr. Safdar Sarki's. They have ignored him.
That's a charge U.S. officials dispute. Last week, a court in Zob granted Sarki bail. An hour later, that was overruled by a higher court. Sarki remains in solitary confinement. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Islamabad.
The northern Iraqi city of Mosul is the scene of some of the fiercest fighting in the country. So the Iraqi government dispatched about 9,000 Iraqi army troops to help U.S. forces there. The trouble is some residents see the troops as members of their ethnic group. NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro explains.
Among the Iraqi soldiers garrisoned at a combat outpost on the banks of the Tigris River, there is one language that predominates. Almost the entire detachment here is Kurdish. Many don't even speak Arabic. Former Peshmerga, as the Kurdish militiamen are called, they form the bulk of the Iraqi army in this city now. Mosul is a mixed city, Sunni Arabs, Shia, Kurds, Yazidis, Christians, and Turkmen. The balance of power is finely calibrated. The presence of a large number of Kurdish security forces is unwelcome by some. Lieutenant Colonel Michael Simmering is with the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment.
When you had the government stand up, you had a disaffected Sunni Arab population that, quite honestly, because their needs weren't being addressed, sided with the insurgency in hopes that that would eventually bring them back to power. I think over time what they're starting to realize is that walking out on the elections in 2005 was something that they will openly admit was a mistake.
The Sunni Arabs boycotted the elections that year, and the result was a Kurdish victory in Mosul. 31 out of 41 members of the provincial council are affiliated with Kurdish parties. The deployment of Kurdish forces here has tipped the balance even further.
One of the grievances that's listed by the Sunni population is that they perceive the Iraqi army as the Kurdish Peshmerga.
And one only has to enter Sunni Arab areas to see that many people there don't like it. The mission for Delta Platoon with the 1st Battalion 8th Infantry Regiment was seemingly simple. Head out to a residential neighborhood in the eastern part of the city and try and engage the local population. The military calls it conducting atmospherics. It's a way of taking the temperature of a new area they may have not patrolled before and getting information.
So this is a really quiet neighborhood through here?
A PSYOP soldier attached to the unit questions a man sitting in a group by the side of the road. The man assures the American that there has never been an attack here. But at the same moment, another resident tells an NPR Iraqi staffer that gunmen came a few days ago and burnt the generator that powers the local cell phone tower. The Americans get back into their vehicles, and not more than 100 feet down the street, they come under fire. There are no casualties or damage, but Captain Alexander Rasmussen says the message to the population was clear.
And when they fire small amounts of, you know, rounds at it, they're not looking to do as much damage to us. But it's trying to intimidate the people is what it's trying to do.
The tactic, though, is effective. No one wants to talk about the insurgents, but almost everyone has something to say about the Iraqi army. 22-year-old Moheb Sullivan is a Kurd living in a predominantly Sunni Arab neighborhood.
There's a lot of tensions. A lot of people talk about it. Some people hate us, hate Kurds. Because, you know, there's Peshmerga, there's a lot of army are Kurds. So they hate army, especially Iraqi army. They're not good with the people.
In another area, the complaints are similar. The army is more expected than the mostly Sunni Arab police, but people say they are heavy-handed. Ahmed Yunus, a Sunni Arab, works at the central bank in Mosul.
People are scared of the Peshmerga because they hurt people. They break stuff. They kick whole families out.
But the American soldier who is talking to him doesn't get to hear what Yunus is saying. His translator, a Kurd, instead tells him that Yunus is talking about the insurgents who terrorized the neighborhood. Back at the garrison, Sergeant Major Hussein Ali, a Kurd with the Iraqi army, acknowledges that their presence is sometimes not well received in Sunni districts of the city.
Even the ones who like us lie when they're asked. They can't say they like us because people are afraid of the terrorists.
Then he turns to brief his men on their next patrol. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Mosul.
It's 2:52. Pontiac and Iroquois County leaders are bitterly disappointed in the federal government's denial of a disaster declaration following last month's floods. Charlie Schlenker reports the lack of that official designation will prevent many homeowners from rebuilding.
Ice crunches outside the modest Robin's Egg Blue home of Rose and Jim Keith on Paser Street in Pontiac. There's a wide, water-stained strip from the ground 3 feet up on the side of the house after last month's flood. Walking in the door, the nose stings with mold, surprisingly strong even in single-digit cold. A jumble of goods is on the floor in one room where the water's bumped and tumbled them. Dirt cakes the tile. Black mold grows on the stove, yet a mud-stained dish towel still hangs neatly from the oven handle. The night of the flood, the Keiths say the waters only took 5 minutes to start coming in the house after crossing the road. They scurried to lift things out of the freezing, mucky rivulets. 3 hours later, feet numb, they gave up, picked up their 10-month-old grandson, and sloshed out in waist-high freezing water.
He's sitting in his high chair watching the water come in around him.
He was scared. Eventually, he got used to it, you know, just seeing the water and all the stuff floating by.
The Keiths had lived in the house 21 years. They're 50 years old. Jim is on disability and couldn't even lift much to pack it out of the house. They say it will be impossible for them to start over without any kind of help.
It can't be repaired. There's too much damage. We can't do anything anymore. It's just, we've lost everything. We're down to no house, no belongings to speak of, and no money to try and rebuild.
The Keiths are in the classic trap. Homeowners insurance doesn't handle floods. Flood insurance, even if they had it, would only take care of the structure. And federal help for the Keiths and hundreds of other residents of Livingston and Iroquois counties won't likely be forthcoming. After sending a crew to review the flooding, the Federal Emergency Management Agency declined to issue a federal disaster declaration, saying the problems were not beyond the local and state authorities' ability to cope. That rankles Pontiac Mayor Scott McCoy. McCoy says there's no way the FEMA team could have completed their assessment in the time given, and that the feds didn't communicate clearly that the declaration hinged on an incomplete list of damages.
It is our belief that these numbers are not only incorrect, but they're not even close. And now our communities are behind the eight ball, and it's up to us to get our own, use our own resources and personnel to do what IEMA and FEMA apparently could not do in a week.
Pontiac and Watsika have only a week to finish their count before the appeal deadline. It's complicated by the fact there's been more flooding in Iroquois County, but McCoy says they have already turned up significantly higher numbers. Gene Baker, a spokesman for FEMA, rejects the notion the agency should take the blame for any failure of communication on how to assess the damage.
FEMA staff went to absolutely every location that the state and local government had pre-identified. Their role is to pre-identify the locations that we need to see, and in fact, the team leader, before leaving, asked, "Have we seen everything you want us to see?" And the answer was yes.
There's finger-pointing on both sides. Pontiac officials say FEMA told them they would bring in three teams. FEMA says that's how many people state officials told them would be needed. Mayor McCoy says politics enters everything.
I'm tired of hearing that we're a blue state. We are a red state with a blue top. I know from reading the news over in Indiana that all of their counties, or the majority of them, I'm not sure how many it was, 12 or something like that, all received their declarations. Our two counties did not in Illinois. Plain to that what you will.
FEMA's Baker strongly disagrees with the assertion.
Let me just say that a disaster is awful, whether it happens to one person or you're one of 10,001. And we at FEMA work under the Stafford Act to provide the service. And we do this year in and year out, no matter who is in office.
Without FEMA assistance for individual homeowners, the communities say they will be affected for years. Watsika Mayor Pro Tem Silas Light says he can only imagine homeowner despair because the floods hit the working poor the hardest, those least able to recover.
We will lose some of the displaced people, property will be abandoned, and tax base will be eroded, and that will affect the city, the school districts, the township's taxing bodies.
Back in their house, Jim Keith walks past open plastic tool drawers that still have flood water trapped in them. He pries open a fridge and points out a muddy shelf of ice above the crisper, the high watermark preserved in the winter chill. Rose Keith says they continue to hope FEMA will reverse its ruling, because without it, at the age of 50, they'll be living with their parents for a long time to come.
And you just keep going in a circle and a circle and a circle, and you're not getting anywhere.
FEMA says they'll look at the additional numbers, and it's not unknown for the agency to reverse a ruling on appeal. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Earth and Sky.
A 2008 study shows that Earth's changing climate has caused available water to shrink in the western U.S. during the last half century. And even bigger changes lie ahead, according to lead author Tim Barnett of Scripps Oceanographic Institution in San Diego.
It's a 20% decrease on average over the western U.S. in the snowpack as it exists on the 1st of April.
Barnett's study compared 50 years of river and climate data with computer models. It showed that in the western U.S., about 60% of changes, such as shrinking snowpack, can only have a non-natural explanation, a human-induced rise in temperature caused by greenhouse gases. Barnett added that water supplies in the western U.S. might be disrupted within 20 years. I asked him how people will adapt.
Some of the adaptations will be conservation. Some will be taking it from farmers and giving it to a growing population. A decent adaptation would be to limit the population growth and development in the western United States. I don't think that'll ever happen. But those are the kind of things that we're going to have to do.
Barnett is concerned about the environmental future we're leaving for the coming generations.
We're altering the climate of the planet in ways that we know and lots of ways we don't know. We're making a world for today's children and grandchildren that they're going to have to live in the future. And if they don't like it, there won't be a thing they can do about it.
I'm Jorge Salazar for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programming is made possible in part by the U of I College of Law, offering students the resources of a major research university, a world-renowned faculty, and opportunities for active learning both in the classroom and beyond. More information and a schedule of upcoming public lectures are available at www.law.uiuc.edu.
380 listeners contributed a little over $50,000 during our one-day campaign last week. Thank you for demonstrating your support for WILL. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. The forecast for Illinois and Indiana tonight: in northwestern Illinois, becoming mostly cloudy, elsewhere clear to partly cloudy, lows ranging from 12 in northern Indiana to 27 in southwestern Illinois.